Today, I'm very proud to present the managers who will bring the case, which we have great confidence in terms of impeaching the president and his removal. But this further evidence insists that, and we wouldn't be in this situation had we not waited, insists that there be witnesses and that we see documentation.
The House has voted to send the articles of impeachment against President Trump to the Senate. Nancy Pelosi also named California Congressman Adam Schiff and Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren as two of the seven impeachment managers for the trial that's expected to begin next week. Lawmakers addressed the nearly month-long delay in sending the articles of impeachment across the building to the Senate. Here's California Republican and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy.
Instead of sending the articles of impeachment to the Senate for trial, Speaker Pelosi held them hostage in a failed play to gain leverage that she did not and would never have. In terms of concessions, she got nothing. No control, no moral victories. In other words, another failed strategy.
There was also a trove of new documents and evidence related to Lev Parnas, Rudy Giuliani, and their role in the Ukraine scandal. We're going to talk about all this now with Congressman Adam Schiff, who joins us now to talk about what's next as the Senate takes up the impeachment of President Trump. Welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Okay, so you are one of the impeachment managers during the Senate trial. What's next for you?
Well, I think quite literally what we will do is we will enroll the resolution that just passed naming the managers, and we will walk it over to the Senate. And then I think McConnell has said that the trial will begin in earnest on Tuesday, and that will start with motions to hear witnesses, motions to subpoena documents. We'll get some indication at that time whether they're serious about a fair trial or whether they're just trying to sweep this under the rug.
There are four senators who say that they are open to voting on whether to call witnesses. Does that give you some hope that witnesses will eventually be called, or do you think that's just window dressing?
You know, I think it's encouraging that a number of senators are willing to buck their leadership and say, no, we're going to take an oath. We mean that seriously. And what's more, the American people deserve a real trial, a fair trial. The president does too, but so do the American people. It's important to point out, though, that even those senators are saying they don't want to have to decide this on the front end. They'll postpone it till later. If we're following the Clinton model, then one thing is for sure they should insist on the administration turning over all the documents before the trial. That's what happened in the Clinton impeachment. And even the issue on the witnesses was different in Clinton because all of the witnesses in the Clinton impeachment had testified before the trial. So their testimony was a known commodity, and the only issue was, do we need to hear them again, and do we really want Monica Lewinsky to be talking about sex on the Senate floor? Those are obviously not the issues here today, and the witnesses we're seeking are witnesses the president prohibited from testifying before the House. So it's a very different situation that McConnell is trying to compare, and so I would hope these senators and others would be willing to stand up to their own leadership if necessary, because their leadership is working hand in hand with the subject of the impeachment, the president, and insist on both documents and witnesses.
Speaking of documents, a whole new trove of documents was released yesterday by Rudy Giuliani associate Lev Parnas, or he gave them to the House, who then released them. What is new in this trove of new documents, and how will that affect what comes next?
The documents, and we're still going through them because we've got quite a voluminous amount of materials from Mr. Parnas, corroborate some incriminating information that we already knew, and that is we found in the documents a letter from Giuliani to the president of Ukraine seeking a meeting, saying that he had a particular matter to discuss with the president of Ukraine, and most significantly that he was doing this with a consultation and approval of the president of the United States. And so if the president, and so far, you know, the defense that they've made in the House has been one of merely attacking the process, if they're going to try to attempt to claim that Giuliani was acting on his own, this evidence directly refutes that. We have in writing from Giuliani, he's doing this on behalf of his client. So when the president likes to say this is just about a phone call, no, this letter, this attempt to have this meeting with Zelensky, with Giuliani, was months before that call. And so you can see the prep work that went into it. It wasn't a surprise to either Zelensky or anyone else that the president would try to coerce him on that call into doing his political dirty work.
And that meeting that Giuliani was trying to arrange, was that meeting specifically about Burisma, Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, et cetera?
Yes. What Giuliani says in the letter is that he has a particular matter to discuss. But we know from other witnesses and other materials that he was going to Ukraine, and in fact, we know this from Giuliani himself, he was going to Ukraine to get them to do these investigations, particularly of Biden. In fact, he was on television around the same time trying to get this. He was trying to get this meeting with Zelensky, saying that he's not meddling in the election, he's meddling in the investigation. So he admitted publicly that he was going there to meddle and try to get this investigation of the president's apparently most feared rival.
Right. I believe he actually said that to the New York Times as well. He said that he was going there to get information on Burisma and Joe Biden. I want to just play a clip of tape from House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. He was criticizing Speaker Pelosi's delay in sending over the articles of impeachment.
We saw separation of powers prevail against an abuse of power, just as the Constitution intends. The idea of withholding a sloppy impeachment case to force the Senate to change its rules is constitutionally and politically unheard of. Frankly, it's just ridiculous.
Okay, so your response to that, waiting until now to send the articles, does that undermine the sense of urgency the House conveyed when they made sure to vote on impeachment before the end of last year?
No, what it did do is it flushed out how the Senate doesn't intend to hold a fair trial. Yes, there's urgency because the president's trying to cheat in the next election, but you can't meet that urgency if essentially the Senate leader is going to cook the books and make sure there is no fair trial in the Senate. And that was made public over the last two or three weeks by waiting and not allowing McConnell to sweep this under the rug. So I think what Mr. McCarthy is complaining about is it was very effective. And the result of it was senators were forced to come forward and say, yes, we do want to hear from witnesses. No, we don't want this to be a sham. And that's what Mr. McCarthy is really complaining about. Now, it's important to know with Mr. McCarthy, he does nothing. He doesn't tie his shoes. He doesn't walk down the street without getting Donald Trump's approval and blessing and pat on the back before and after. So when you hear him speaking on the House floor elsewhere, these are essentially talking points that he's instructed to use, and he's only too happy to use them.
Well, it appears, aside from the four senators we discussed earlier, Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, Lisa Murkowski, and Lamar Alexander, it appears that the rest of the Senate Republicans are willing to line up behind Mitch McConnell and the president and try not to call witnesses. However, there is this idea that if they do agree to call, let's say, John Bolton, that they would want to also call Hunter Biden. What would be your response to that?
Well, Hunter Biden doesn't have any testimony that's really relevant to the issues for which the president has been impeached. He's been impeached for withholding hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer aid to try to coerce Ukraine into investigating his rival. Hunter Biden can't shed any light on whether that money was withheld or why it was withheld or what the president was doing. Likewise, the president withheld meeting with the president of Ukraine for the same reason, and that's not something Hunter Biden can shed light on either. Now, John Bolton can. And so what the senators seem to be saying, some of the Republicans who are afraid of what John Bolton might have to say, is if you call John Bolton, we're going to call someone who has no relevant testimony, but who we hope that we'll be able to smear Joe Biden with. And this was, of course, the whole point of the effort to try to coerce Ukraine was to get them to smear Joe Biden. I would hope the senators would not opt in favor of that kind of a circus and diminishment of the seriousness of the issues. But it's plain that's their stratagem anyway.
And are you entirely confident that if John Bolton did testify, that his testimony would be damaging to the president? I mean, he is a Republican Party guy. He's been on Fox News for years. Could he say something that would damage your case?
You know, I have really no idea what Mr. Bolton would have to say, but I think he should be heard. However it cuts, I think he should be heard. He clearly has relevant information. We know that much. But not only Mr. Bolton, Mick Mulvaney admitted publicly that they withheld this military aid in part so the president could get these political investigations he wanted. He's a very relevant witness, and he should testify, and so should the person who is heading the budget office and Mulvaney's deputy. These are all very relevant witnesses. So I would hate to rely on just any one of them when there are any number that have information that would help the senators reach a fair verdict. So it's not just about Bolton. And, you know, I would say even more than the witnesses at times, the documents can be the most revealing because witnesses can lie. The documents seldom do. And we have seen both in the documents we've gotten from Mr. Parnas, the documents that have been released as part of these Freedom of Information Act requirements, that the paper record is among the most damning. And so all of these documents the president has been sitting on, cables at the State Department, internal discussions at the Office of Management Budget about how they were likely violating the law by withholding this money, all of that should come into the trial record, and I would hope there'd be as much effort to produce that as there is to produce witness testimony.
Congressman Adam Schiff, one of seven House managers of President Trump's upcoming impeachment trial. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, wedged in the middle of Trump's impeachment over dealings with Ukraine is the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. As we talked about with Congressman Schiff, new documents released yesterday show Giuliani claiming he was acting on behalf of the president. So how did Rudy Giuliani go from being America's mayor and the face of New York's response to 9/11 to a key player in this impeachment scandal? Here to tell me about Giuliani is Jonathan Mahler. He profiled Rudy for the next issue of the New York Times Magazine. Hi there.
Hi.
So let's begin by trying to understand why Rudy Giuliani was hanging out with Lev Parnas in the first place. How did they become associated?
Yeah, sure. So as a sort of private businessman, Rudy Giuliani had kind of a lot of different clients. He's sort of always out looking for new business. And he's sort of a consultant, security consultant. Obviously, he also has this access to the president, you know, which makes him attractive to private companies, to countries, to cities. And so in the case of Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, they were getting a new business off the ground. They were going to try to sell natural gas to various foreign countries, including Ukraine. And so they hired Rudy, paid him $500,000 for sort of unspecified services, but advice, consulting, et cetera.
And they had a company, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, called Fraud Guarantee, which
correct
is quite a name.
You can't make it up.
Given the circumstances, what was this company?
So it's not entirely clear what Fraud Guarantee really does or did. It was a company that Parnas created, and they don't seem to really have any clients. There are no identifiable clients. I think Parnas at one point described it as a company that was intended to help investors prevent themselves from getting defrauded, and he himself has had some legal problems. So there's been some speculation that he actually created this company to sort of clean up his Google search, so that when you put Lev Parnas and fraud into Google, you would, instead of getting some stories about the various penny brokerages that he worked for, you would get the listing for his company, Fraud Guarantee.
So let's take a step back and look at Giuliani's role in all this and just his role in general as it has evolved. He is now under investigation by the Southern District. This is an office that he used to run as U.S. attorney.
Yeah.
So that's quite a change in circumstances. How did he get to that?
Not only did he run it, he was right. Not only did he run the Southern District, the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District, but he was probably one of the most famous U.S. attorneys that's ever held that job.
Right. And he would go after public corruption. He would go after mob figures. He was seen as someone who really was a defender of the Constitution against people who would purport to undermine it.
Yeah, he was a crusading prosecutor, and he really made his name prosecuting public corruption, municipal corruption. I mean, the mob also. It's certainly not a stretch to say that the types of people he prosecuted were the types of people he's now engaged with.
And so your article is really an exploration into whether Giuliani changed or whether America changed.
That's right.
And did you come to a conclusion doing all this research into Giuliani's history, whether or not he has become a different person, he has sacrificed his values, or were his values always fungible?
I think they were always fungible, at least to a degree. I mean, he's always been someone who, you know, who really was sort of willing to do whatever was necessary to win, was always kind of pushing the boundaries. And really, I think, you know, what happened here is that he was out of the limelight for a while. He was desperate to get back in. Trump brought him back in. He's always also been someone who is very kind of obsessed with power, developing power, cultivating power, wielding power. And, he was in a position to do that really in a way he was protected by attorney-client privilege, or so he believed as the president's lawyer. And he had the blessing of the president of the United States. So I think in some ways, a guy who'd sort of always been pushing the boundaries, always wanted to get away with anything he could, suddenly felt like he could really get away with anything.
And I wonder if he is truly worried that his reputation has now been squandered or has been tarnished for good. America's mayor to this.
It's a good question. I mean, it's generally not Giuliani's nature to worry. It's not his nature to look back. It's not his nature to sort of second guess himself or have any doubts about the sort of path that he's chosen. So I think on some level, he's just kind of barreling ahead. And certainly we've seen, you know, even as he's been caught up in this impeachment drama, he's continued to fly around the world. He's continued to go on TV and on social media to sort of press this baseless case against the Bidens, this really, you know, conspiracy theory. And so there's certainly no indication at this point that he's having any doubts or showing any shame.
Is part of the question about whether he changed or America changed, when you look back at the tabloid culture of the 80s and 90s, both Giuliani and Trump were key fixtures in the sort of New York tabloid world. So I guess it's kind of interesting that now these two have become key fixtures in the current world. It's not a tabloid world, but it is a world that is tabloid-esque.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's something I write about a bit in the piece, just this idea that in some ways the sort of the tabloid culture of the 80s and 90s was kind of the beginning of our modern media era. This, you know, it's this sort of environment where, you know, kind of the more outrageous your statements or the more outrageous your gestures are, the more attention they get. And then it's on to the next day, and the news cycles already was sort of accelerated during the tabloid wars. And now it's vastly more accelerated with social media and 24-hour cable. So yes, in some ways, I think he was, you know, both Giuliani and Trump were kind of trained in that media environment. And now they're, you know, kind of thriving to the extent that Giuliani is still thriving.
And I guess I just want to circle back to one point. So here is Rudy Giuliani, who made his name and his career as someone who was a defender of truth and justice and right over wrong. And now it seems that he's trading in the sort of foggy world of, well, this is how we're interpreting it, or even in blatant untruths, because this whole Biden thing is, you know, it's just not true. So I guess was that just an act that he was this in the earlier iteration?
I think one thing to remember is, so this is sort of a more kind of general observation, but I do think it's relevant. I think people tend to think of these prosecutors as, these kind of, I don't know, if not priestly, then at least, you know, kind of ethically driven people who understand the difference between right and wrong and who are, you know, kind of fixated on enforcing that line. You know, it's also possible that because Rudy was so sort of theatrical and was so public and so sort of publicity oriented and was building his political persona, his persona as a prosecutor became, you know, sort of deliberately became his persona as a politician, when in reality, you know, he was just doing his job as a prosecutor.
Jonathan Mahler is staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. You can read his cover story, The Fog of Rudy Giuliani, in the current issue. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Coming up, the Oakland moms who were evicted in a house that they didn't own became a symbol in the larger gentrification fight. What's next for them? Next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A follow-up to a story we covered last week. Two Oakland moms who were living in a home that did not belong to them were evicted yesterday. There were others who were living in the house as well, two of whom were arrested and released hours later. The home in the West Oakland area is owned by a Redondo Beach-based company called Wedgewood. And Wedgewood purchased the house at a foreclosure auction and plans to renovate it and sell it at a market rate. But before that happened, Dominique Walker, a single mother of two, moved in. I spoke with her last week.
The house on Magnolia Street was an eyesore on the block, doing work in the community. Folks pointed to this house in particular, saying it's been vacant, and just letting us know all the vacancies in their neighborhood when we're talking about people being homeless. Looking for housing, it was very difficult because of gentrification and corporations speculating in our communities. It's impossible to be able to afford, even with multiple jobs, to afford the rent here.
Well, I also spoke with Sam Singer, a representative from the company Wedgewood, which forced the eviction of the moms.
What Wedgewood does is the company goes in, it takes distressed homes, homes that have been foreclosed upon, it rehabilitates them, it employs local people, local real estate agents, painters, contractors, and it fixes those homes up and it sells them, the vast majority of the time, to first-time home buyers. So they're a housing creator, whereas these individuals, these squatters, are housing destroyers.
Well, joining us now is Molly Solomon, reporter for KQED in San Francisco, who's been covering this story. Hi, Molly.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Great to have you. Well, what led to the eventual eviction of these women?
So, yes, we have to go back, like you said, a week before Thanksgiving. That's when the moms moved in with their kids to this vacant home in West Oakland. They'd been staying there, and they weren't doing it in secret. I mean, they were doing it very publicly, specifically to make a point. They chose this house because it was owned by that company, Wedgewood, which they felt like was letting it sit empty, letting it sit vacant in a place that is facing a very extreme homelessness crisis. Eventually, on Friday, a judge ruled that the women would have to leave. It was kind of a climax in this case that had played out where Wedgewood was telling the women that they were going to force an eviction. That did come down. The sheriff's office showed up and forced the eviction. They carried out early Tuesday morning.
Was there any doubt that that would be what would happen, that the judge would rule in favor of Wedgewood?
You know, the judge did take a while to consider this, and he had initially came out in favor of the company in a tentative ruling. But, you know, he let the women make their argument through their lawyers, and he considered the case for about a week and a half. I don't think that people were entirely surprised that he was going to enforce this ruling. He did say in the court hearing that he didn't feel like the question that the women were arguing, which was that they believed that housing is a human right, and that was sort of their moral argument that they were making to stay in the home. He felt like that wasn't a decision that his courtroom was the right place to have that conversation.
So yesterday, they're evicted. What did that scene look like?
So About 5:15 a.m. is when 30 sheriff deputies, they rolled up to the house on Magnolia Street. It was pre-dawn. It was dark. And they had waited because before that, the mothers had gotten a tip that they might come. And, you know, within about 20 minutes, they had sent a text alert to supporters. You know, hundreds of people showed up on the street. Overnight, those people, you know, dissipated. A small crowd remained, but largely most people had left by the time the sheriff's office came. They banged down the door and arrested two of the moms as well as two supporters, and they shut down the occupation.
And Dominique, whom we just heard from, she spoke after they were evicted. What did she say?
Dominique was actually not in the house at the time of the eviction that the sheriff showed up. She was doing an interview, and she came down and gave a statement. Here she is now talking about the eviction.
This house was a statement. It was a symbol of what needs to happen in Oakland. This was an absolute victory. We're still victorious, and we're going to keep it moving.
Make it a movement.
Do you know what you'll do next?
Keep organizing. This is a movement. It's ongoing. We here.
And after the press conference, she headed down to Santa Rita Jail to bail out the two moms and the two organizers who were arrested. They actually came back to the house later that day to have, I guess, like a celebration, a community barbecue. They held it outside the home on the street in front of the house.
Hmm. So where is she going now, Dominique?
I mean, for now, she's got friends, family. A lot of community members have reached out with help. So I think in the short term, she's probably got a place to be. But I mean, when you're looking for something more permanent here, I think that's the bigger question that remains to be seen. You know, I don't want to speak for her and the other moms, but I think that they always knew that this eviction would come down and that staying there permanently at the house was, you know, kind of a long shot. But yeah. I think in the bigger sense here, this is what they wanted. You know, they wanted us to think about, you know, that this is bigger than just this one house. It's bigger than Oakland. And just getting us all to talk about that, to, you know, kind of ask that question, is housing a human right? And to shine a spotlight on these companies like Wedgewood is a win.
Right. I mean, they chose a home that was owned by a company, not owned by a homeowner.
Exactly. And that was very specific. And, you know, they've been working with different groups that have been doing this kind of housing justice work. Dominique herself is a community organizer, and is part of her story is saying that, you know, as she was out there doing housing justice work with this group that's assisted them throughout this occupation in this home, that's sort of when she saw that, you know, the face of homelessness in this town, Oakland, where she's been, you know, grew up, was born and raised, has really changed and looked like her. You know, she couldn't afford to be here. She had been couch surfing at relatives' homes, you know, in further flung places like Stockton and Antioch. And it really sort of catapulted her to do this and to do this at a very specific house.
And this specific house, what will happen to it now?
Wedgewood has already changed a little bit. They've put up a chain link fence around the house. They boarded up the doors and windows. They've hired security to secure the home, I guess, from having people move back into it and reoccupy it. And Wedgewood maintains that they're going to fix it up and put it back on the market. And that's their business plan. That's what they do. They flip homes that they purchase through either foreclosure auctions or, like they said, you know, what they call distressed properties. And so we'll see how that pans out.
Well, Molly, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. That's Molly Solomon, housing affordability reporter at KQED in San Francisco. Coming up, how to fix California's broken recycling system, plus the history of war and drugs and war on drugs, including World War II and Adolf Hitler.
He criticized drunkards and smokers and so on, but his own personal doctor was giving him regular injections, a concoction of vitamins and amphetamines and other things that he was highly dependent on.
A new book looks at how illicit substances have been an integral part of war. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, last year was a bad one for recycling here in California. Hundreds of recycling centers closed down. You know, those places where you can go redeem bottles and cans for 5 or 10 cents a piece. Well, fewer places to recycle means less recycling. There's a plan now to fix that. At the state capitol today, a Senate committee debated changes to California's 1987 bottle bill. Specifically, the bill envisions beverage companies to come up with their own recycling programs for their products. With me to talk about it is Lisa Tucker, consumer advocate with Consumer Watchdog, which recently published a year-long investigation into the failures of California's bottle bill. Hey, Lisa.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. What is the takeaway from your investigation? What's the major failure?
Well, the major failure right now is that our entire bottle deposit system has really been trashed by a system that's been government run, that's been pretty inefficient, by underpayments to a whole network of redemption centers that this whole bottle bill was built on. And all these centers are closing and people have no place to take their bottles and cans. So there's less than half than there were.
So what is the problem? People go to take their bottles to these places, they get the 5 or 10 cents, and then what? These centers aren't getting reimbursed?
Let me just make this really, really simple. We have a bottle bill that's broken. It's broken because we never made the makers and the retailers of sodas and beer and juice and, you know, fruit juice, bottled water, take responsibility for the wrappers around their products, those containers that are empties. Our system basically was born out of a lot of lobbying by industry. And what it did was it said, we're going to have a bunch of redemption centers where people can go and take back their bottles and cans. And retailers have nothing to do with this unless those redemption centers start to close. That system does not work. And the retailers are turning people away even when they have a legal obligation to take back the bottles and cans because they know they can get away with it because we have an ineffective enforcement system by the agency that runs this program. There are only 4 centers in San Francisco right now serving 900,000 residents. Who is going to stand in a line for 4 hours? Same deal. 45 of Los Angeles's 88 cities have no recycling centers left. We have no access. So this deposit that's supposed to be refundable has turned into a tax.
Why can't we just take our bottles back to the store?
Very good question, and that's exactly where the system has to go. The characteristics of successful bottle deposit programs, and we've looked at a lot, makes the beverage industry responsible for crafting and running a program with oversight by the state. All the Safeways and the Albertsons and the Ralphs and the CVSs and, you know, the big box stores, the Targets that sell beverages, all of them are required to redeem in every single location except California. The deposit amounts are higher. There is a correlation between higher deposits and, you know, an incentive for people to take back their bottles and cans, and ours is traditionally lower than a lot of other places. All of those things count.
So a lot of people, though, think, okay, I'm not going to bother with taking my bottles and cans back to the store. I'm just going to put them in the blue bin. What's wrong with that?
Well, there is a lot wrong with that. The waste haulers would have you think that this is very convenient. Just pile everything together in that blue recycling bin that's recyclable, including your bottles and cans, and that somehow magically it's all being recycled. Nothing could be further from the truth. The bottom line is they wanted to save themselves a lot of money. So they came up with this idea of one single bin when we used to actually divert things into different bins. And it saves them money on everything. Labor, trucks only need one compartment. The problem with this whole thing is that A, consumers sometimes think something's recyclable. It's a wish recycling. They put something in that's not. Or maybe they don't understand that, you know, they won't be able to compost your coffee grounds.
And they contaminate everything. Everything gets contaminated and can't be recycled.
1 in 4 things basically in a single bin are contaminated. But see, what's going on is when those trucks pick that up and put it into a single compartment, it's smashed, it's compacted. All that stuff laces through a load and makes it literally unusable. There is too high a contamination rate. So the single bins have a contamination rate of at least 35%, which means that stuff ends up incinerated or in landfills. If you put it through a bottle deposit program where you're actually separating this stuff completely from everything else, it's like 98% clean. Why is that important? Because it can then be made into a comparably valuable product, a bottle to a bottle.
So why don't we also have a system where we have separate bins for that stuff? Because that seems to be kind of the bigger issue. Most people probably won't be taking a lot of their bottles and cans back to the store, but they do want to recycle.
Well, look, I actually don't agree with that. I mean, the bottom line is that if it is just as easy to recycle your bottles and cans at the retailer you use to do your shopping, why wouldn't you do that? You just, when you go once a week or twice a week or however often you go to the store, you just take a, you know, modestly sized bag of your bottles and cans with you. You feed it into a reverse vending machine. You know, other states have this advanced technology. It spits out, you know, cash or credit that you can use right in the store. It is the most convenient way to do this, is to make it as easy to get your bottle deposits redeemed as it is to buy the beverages in the first place.
Okay, and so this bill that's now being debated in the Capitol would do this?
Well, the bill debated in the Capitol actually sets up a central concept critical to all of what I'm saying. It creates an extended producer responsibility program that then puts it onto the beverage industry to craft how it is going to work. Retail stores should be obligated to redeem in stores part of this. It's going to be up to the beverage cooperative to figure out all of the rules and procedures and sit down with all the stakeholders and make this work. And what that's going to involve is helping the retailers by paying them a proper fee for actually handling all of this.
Well, I imagine the lobbying forces are out in force.
No, of course they're not going to see a change, because they've been free riders. And it is us Californians that are funding this with deposits that are supposed to be refundable but aren't, and have turned into a tax. And it's time to basically turn this whole thing back onto its head. We need our money, our nickels and dimes back. It's a very big quantity of money. We spend $1.5 billion a year in nickels and dimes, and we're only getting back barely half of that. That is number one. And number two, we need to make sure that more bottles and cans are being recycled. And right now, at least 6 billion of them are being landfilled or incinerated. So we need to fix this.
All right, Lisa, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Lisa Tucker is an advocate with Consumer Watchdog. She wrote their report, Trashed: How California Recycling Failed and How to Fix It. Coming up, long before the drug war, there were wars for drugs with soldiers on drugs. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
As we mobilize for this national crusade, I'm mindful that drugs are a constant temptation for millions. Please remember this when your courage is tested. You are Americans.
Our outrage against drugs unites us, brings us together behind this one plan of action: an assault on every front.
The war on drugs. The U.S. has been fighting it ever since President Nixon declared warfare in 1971. But drugs and war have been inseparable for centuries, from ancient Rome to Imperial Britain to Vietnam up to today. Drugs have been taken, taxed, fought over, and exploited not just by illegal traffickers and so-called narco-terrorists, but by powerful states. My next guest argues that six psychoactive drugs have been particularly potent war ingredients. Peter Andreas's new book is called Killer High: A History of War in Six Drugs. And Peter Andreas joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you say you can't talk about war without talking about drugs, and you can't understand the history of drugs without considering war. And you chose six drugs to look at. And they're alcohol, tobacco, caffeine, opium, amphetamine or speed, and cocaine. Why did you choose those six and not, let's say, marijuana or LSD?
Right. I mean, I was actually indifferent about which drugs to choose going into the research, but it was through the survey of the historical record that I was struck by the fact that the world's most popular illicit drug, marijuana, doesn't score as high in its war importance as these other drugs. It probably, if I added another chapter, if I had History of War and Seven Drugs, cannabis would make the list. And actually, arguably, sugar, if we think of it as a drug, it's a bit of a stretch, but some people consider it a drug. That definitely should have made the list.
Well, number one on your list is alcohol. And I guess that is the most widely used substance. Is that fair to say?
I would say actually caffeine, which I have a whole chapter on, tea and coffee, and then a ton of different caffeinated beverages. But a lot of people, it's such a benign drug that a lot of people don't even think of it as a drug. And it's my drug of choice. It's my favorite drug. I can't live without it. But alcohol is the oldest war drug, if you will. I mean, going back, as you say, to Rome, but long before, in fact. We can't explain how France even became the world's most famous wine-producing region without understanding Roman conquest. Bordeaux became wine arrived there through the Romans before it was primarily a beer-drinking place.
Oh, that's interesting. And also one really interesting tidbit and a pretty gruesome tidbit that you put in there is the Norse tradition of drinking out of the skulls of their enemies, hence the toast, right. Skål.
Exactly.
Ooh.
Yes. That's luckily, that's a tradition that has died.
So your general thesis, though, is what? That you can't have war without these mind-altering substances?
I don't want to overstate the linkage, but I think if we tell the history of war without including drugs, or the history of drugs without including war, we miss a lot. And we tend to overlook all sorts of linkages between the two. Some of them are obvious and some of them not so obvious. Some of them are on the home front and some of them are on the war front. And they have long-lasting consequences that we often don't even attribute to war. Things like the coffee break, for example, began with World War II and then became institutionalized in the 1950s, and now we just take it for granted. How the United States turned from rum to whiskey is explained by the American Revolution. Cigarettes became globalized through warfare. The conquest of the Americas obviously was an act of war, and that's how we discovered tobacco in the first place.
Mm. And war was fought over these substances too, right? Rum, for example, and as you say, the Whiskey Rebellion.
That case was an excellent example of a newly independent state that rebelled against British taxation, and then the federal government suddenly needing revenue. And what does it choose to tax? Well, alcohol. And whiskey producers in western Pennsylvania weren't too happy about it. And so George Washington and Hamilton mobilized a militia to suppress the Whiskey Rebellion actually fairly handily. It actually interestingly turned out that the army itself was the main client for Pennsylvania whiskey producers. So they were particularly annoyed that those producers were rebelling.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about a war for drugs, and that is a particular drug, opium. And you argue that Britain was essentially the world's first and biggest drug trafficker.
Yeah, I mean, we use the term narco-state today, and the first thing that comes to mind is perhaps Afghanistan. But arguably, Britain was the world's first true narco-state, even a narco-empire in the sense that it fought a war with Imperial China to keep the floodgates of opium open. It was absolutely crucial to Britain's rise and dominance as an imperial power in the 19th century. Really, what it was all about was they needed something to trade with China in order to afford Chinese tea, and China really didn't have anything else that it wanted to import. And so the British discovered opium. A large Chinese population was increasingly addicted to it. And so, licitly or illicitly, British merchants were supplying this product. The Chinese authorities increasingly tried to criminalize and crack down on the trade. And once they really cracked down, the British actually went to war with them to keep the doors open. Then there was a second opium war, and the result of that was actually China fully legalizing the opium trade. So it wasn't until the early 20th century that the drug actually became criminalized at the global level.
Okay, so let's fast forward to World War II and Nazi Germany. And the Nazis were famously strict when it came to mind-altering substances. They weren't allowed to smoke or drink, right? Hitler was against that.
Yeah, officially, Nazi ideology was also an anti-drug ideology, but it was also hypocritical because amphetamines were kind of a privileged exception because it could keep you more energized, more focused, more awake. And so it kind of fit the Nazi ideal of an energetic, superhuman worker working for a unified cause. And they ended up at the early years of World War II doling out millions of amphetamine tablets to German soldiers. The Blitzkrieg was sped up, if you will, by speed. Sun Tzu once said, speed is the essence of war. He obviously didn't have amphetamines in mind, but he would have been impressed at the ability of the drug to keep people awake and moving.
Well, it wasn't just the Nazis, right? The Japanese, the kamikaze
exactly.
pilots were also using it.
It was not just the Germans or the Japanese. In fact, the Brits and then the Americans also turned to amphetamines to keep their, for example, their pilots awake on long-distance flights. So it was definitely not just the Germans, though they've gotten the most attention because in some ways they pioneered pill-popping on the battlefield. But then even as they were actually turning against it, the Allies were in some ways using more and more supplies of it.
You write that there was a meth factory on a naval base in San Diego.
Right. It shouldn't be that shocking. I mean, the drug was perfectly legal.
Yeah.
You could, you know, benzedrine inhalers were touted to help all sorts of ailments. But the military in particular was targeted. And so, yes, the U.S. forces deployed to the Pacific were certainly well supplied.
And Hitler himself, he was on all sorts of drugs, right? Not just
yes. I mean, the irony is that he, you know, criticized drunkards and smokers and so on, but his own personal doctor was giving him regular injections, a concoction of vitamins and amphetamines and other things that he was highly dependent on.
So drugs have been used throughout history in various wars, battles, skirmishes, and soldiers now are still on drugs, stimulants mainly, or...
Well, it's interesting. Historically, you know, the drugs would not necessarily be medically prescribed, but, you know, today, all sorts of medical prescriptions you can get as a soldier that were not available previously. Arguably, in Vietnam, for example, soldiers were self-medicating. Today, soldiers can get all sorts of prescriptions perfectly legally that were not previously available, including many types of amphetamine-type stimulants, Adderall, Ritalin, and so on. It's the non-state actors, the stateless actors in Syria and elsewhere who turn to drugs as well, but not through legal channels.
Right. And so when you look through the history of the use of drugs on the battlefield, do you see them then when the troops come home, be it from ancient Rome or from wars today, affecting the larger society? Like, do they then transform the use of drugs and substances back home?
Oh, in all sorts of ways, past and present. I mean, today you have veterans coming home addicted to painkillers. But this goes back for centuries, the legacy of war for drug use and often through soldiers returning from combat. For example, British officers came back from fighting Napoleon, attracted to cigars. And so suddenly cigars became extremely popular in Britain. World War II hooked a whole generation on cigarettes, beer. I mean, all sorts of drugs were used during the two world wars that got a new generation of users, mostly men, who then, after the wars ended, continued to be consumers of various sorts. Similarly, women entered the workforce like never before during World War II, new gained freedom, new gained resources to pay for things, and that included cigarettes. So women became a whole new consumer base for cigarette smoking in the post-World War II era.
Do you take any particular moral judgment on this, or are you just documenting this as historical fact?
That's a good question. I think of what I'm doing as a corrective to the tendency to see this phenomena as largely a contemporary issue and a domain of stateless actors, narco-terrorists or narco-insurgents. and to show that it not only goes back centuries, but that legal drugs have been just as important, if not more important, than illegal drugs, and that it's actually powerful states, Great Britain, France, the United States, Russia, who've actually been the biggest beneficiaries of the drugs war relationship.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and the book is called Killer High, A History of War in Six Drugs by Peter Andreas. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And that's it for us here at Press Play. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.